It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. Children's hospitals around the country and here in Wisconsin are facing federal scrutiny over care for transgender youth.
Yesterday, two of Wisconsin's pediatric care providers announced they are pausing gender-affirming medical care for minors.
The statements from Children's Wisconsin and UW Health come less than a month after the Trump administration announced proposed new rules that would block Medicare and Medicaid payments to any hospital or clinic delivering gender-affirming services to patients under 18.
To hear reaction on how this could affect transgender youth, return to Abigail Swetz, Executive Director of FAIR Wisconsin. That's a statewide civil rights and advocacy group for LGBTQ plus rights. Abigail, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Can you explain what medical care is being suspended within the realm of gender-affirming care for youth?
I appreciate the question because I think it's a really important thing to level set what we mean when we talk about gender-affirming care for youth. So a few quick things. First of all, gender-affirming care for trans youth, transition-related healthcare, it is medically necessary for these kids. It is highly individualized, like all good medical care is. You know, we have different bodies, we have different needs. And it is age-appropriate and accessed with full parental consent and in conversation with really, really qualified providers. So when we're talking about these pauses to care due to these federal threats, we are talking for pauses to care that is really necessary because we know when these treatments are able to go forward, our trans youth experience so much less psychological distress. We see their mental health just drastically improve. And so when we're talking about gender-affirming care specifically for youth in that age-appropriate way I was just talking about, there are no medical interventions until puberty. And then possibly there may be puberty pause medications and then possibly hormone treatment to make sure that when puberty does start, it starts in the way that the body would feel like home to this trans child, really in the way that puberty would affirm who they really are. And so when we're talking about these pauses at Children's and at UW, we're talking about changes to access in care that is about those puberty pause medications and about that hormone treatment specifically.
And to note, Children's Wisconsin said they would still provide mental and behavioral health services to minors. Is that care adequate for transgender youth?
That's the right question, because while I am very thankful that Children's will be continuing to provide mental and behavioral health services support, I believe that is true for UW as well. That's not enough. Gender dysphoria, which is the state of a transgender child feeling out of sync with their body, that requires medical treatment in order to truly address the distress that that disconnect can cause and does cause. And so we need more than mental health and behavioral health services. I'm glad we're going to continue to be able to access them. Goodness knows that this vulnerable population is so under attack that their mental health concerns are probably even greater than they were before, because we are talking about a very small population under severe attack from every level of government, including our own state legislature. And frankly, thank goodness mental health services continue, but it's just not enough. It's not the care that these kids need. It's not all the care that these kids need.
Under attack from every level of government, I'm wondering, Wisconsin is a state that does not currently ban gender-affirming care for minors. Are the hospitals bowing to the pressure of the federal government in this moment?
It's the right question. Again, you're very good at the right questions, because it really does direct us to understand the threat is coming from the very top here. And I think this decision is wrong. I think these hospitals should continue providing this care that is so medically necessary to these children, especially because the threats that are coming from the top of this administration through HHS, through these proposed rules from CMS and another secretary's declaration attempting to stop care. The secretary's declaration is already under litigation. The proposed rules are only proposed and currently open for public comment, which FAIR Wisconsin is mobilizing for. That means they're not in effect. So do I think these hospitals made the wrong choice? Yes. Do I think they never should have been put into the position of having to make any kind of choice that would reduce access to this life-affirming care? Also, yes, they should never have been put in that position by this hostile federal government.
We are talking about two Wisconsin hospital systems announcing a pause on gender-affirming care for young patients with Abigail Swetz, the executive director at FAIR Wisconsin. Abigail, this is not the first time that Wisconsin hospitals have had to pause gender-affirming care under the Trump administration. What impact does this uncertainty have on families and patients who are undergoing treatments?
So our families and our patients that are trying to access this care, we have to keep in mind, especially when we're talking about youth gender-affirming care, time matters. When I say that it's age appropriate, it's because your body shifts as you go, as you age, specifically around puberty, which is when medical treatments can start when it comes to gender affirming care. And so time is of the essence. I think we have all, as human beings, experienced what it's like to go through puberty. It is a difficult process for literally anyone. But when your body doesn't match who you are, it is a different kind of distress. And so this is time is of the essence to try and figure out a solution here. And we are working very hard to try and make sure that access can continue outside of these particular hospital systems. But that is a challenge. It is a challenge because our trans kids need this care. Our families need to know that they can access this care. And there is just not enough access to go around right now.
You know, although these new directives, they only target trans youth, I'm wondering, does this stoppage have a ripple effect on the entire community, regardless of someone's age?
Absolutely, right? Because this latest development is not isolated. I think anyone who's been paying any attention to what's going on in with our federal government and even our state legislature knows that these levels of government have been attacking our trans community just in an all-out assault. We have seen these attacks about identity documents, attacks about military service, attacks about gender-affirming care for youth, even attacks about gender-affirming care for adults when it comes to our federal government insurance program no longer covers it. It's a very difficult situation. And I think we have to keep in mind that these attacks are about assaulting a community that is vulnerable and that is also our friends and neighbors. And it's time for the rest of us to really step up and make a difference in stopping those attacks.
You alluded to this earlier. At the state capitol tomorrow, there is a hearing scheduled on a bill in the assembly to ban gender-affirming care for minors. What do you anticipate from that hearing?
I anticipate an outpouring of support and love for our trans kids, because that is what we saw at the hearing in March. We had a hearing on this same bill, same exact bill in March, that lasted hours and hours into the night. And that is because our LGBTQ plus and allied communities, all of us who support and love our trans kids, everyday Wisconsinites who just don't want to see incredible healthcare go away, no matter who it's for, showed up and testified. And that is what's going to happen again tomorrow.
Can we shine a light a moment on FAIR Wisconsin? I'm wondering, what is your organization doing about these issues, doing about these developments in the moment that are coming from the federal and state government that affect LGBTQ plus rights and civil rights?
Thanks for asking. There are really two huge things we're doing to address the attacks on specifically on gender affirming care right now. And the most important one to do is the public comment period, because it is so immediate. And also, I'll say that FAIR Wisconsin is working with our incredible partners at GSAFE to try and set up a fund to help keep access going to this essential healthcare. We haven't figured out all the logistics yet, but please, if people are interested in assisting us in that, stay tuned. We'll have more information soon. But the public comment period is so important, because these proposed rules are only proposed and we cannot let them go into finalization. And we have to lay that groundwork to make sure that if they are finalized, we are able to litigate them effectively. And that means every Wisconsinite who cares about making sure that healthcare that is medically necessary continues to be accessible in our country should public comment. FAIR Wisconsin is hosting multiple webinars teaching people how to public comment in a safe and protected way. We will be holding one on Thursday. Check out our website, fairwisconsin.com, under events to learn a little bit more about that.
You know, acknowledging here you are not a medical doctor, but if a patient would have to stop a treatment abruptly, a gender-affirming care abruptly, can that pause be potentially dangerous physically or have mental consequences?
You are correct. I am not a medical doctor, but I've seen the incredible life-affirming aspects of this care as someone who just knows so many trans kids and trans amazing human beings in my life. And yes, it does have a detrimental effect. It has an effect on the body in a way that makes it less affirming to the person who is undergoing this treatment that has now stopped. And it definitely causes so much mental distress. And, you know, our youth are really already going through so much. Why are we just piling on in a way that takes away access to care that we know works for them?
Do you know at all how long services will be on hold?
I do not. I hope it is a short pause.
Do you think that clinics are kind of abandoning these ongoing treatments? Do they have other remedies here?
Do the patients have other remedies?
Do these clinics that are pausing services have other remedies? Yeah.
I just want to say, I know the providers are in such a difficult place right now because I know our medical professionals understand that this care is so medically necessary for their patients and now are unable to, if they are at these hospital systems, to provide that care. And just my heart goes out to them so much because this is a decision that is being made in the face of these incredible threats against them, right? And these kids. And we are trying to work out a solution that is more outside of an institutionalized setting, outside of hospital systems to make sure this care continues. But in the meantime, wow, it is time to surround our trans kids and their families and these providers with a whole lot of love, right? Because part of this is just knowing that there are so many of us who are trying to fight to protect this care and to protect these incredible people. We're grateful that they are here and we need them to stick around.
Abigail, thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Abigail Swetz is executive director at FAIR Wisconsin. That's a statewide group working to further LGBTQ plus rights. We've been talking about two major pediatric hospital systems in Wisconsin announcing a pause on gender-affirming care for youth. It comes as two proposed rules by the Trump administration seek to eliminate gender-affirming care to transgender patients younger than 18.
Coming up, a small but growing number of doctors are working in direct primary care offices where people subscribe for routine care. A Wisconsin physician tells us why she made the switch.
It allows me to then practice to be the type of doctor that I've always wanted to be so that I can continue to provide kind of full scope family medicine.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Direct primary care, or DPC, is growing in popularity around the country as a supplement or even as an alternative to health insurance.
At direct primary care clinics, patients pay a monthly fee that covers regular doctor's appointments for basic illnesses and injuries, along with preventive services like physicals and cancer screenings.
It's not a form of insurance, and it doesn't cover prescription drugs or services like surgical procedures.
Between 2018 and 2023, the number of DPC and concierge practices grew by 83% nationwide. That's according to new research out of Harvard and Johns Hopkins University. Demand is expected to grow with health insurance premiums going up.
And later, we'll hear from a doctor who runs her own direct primary care practice in Fitchburg.
First, we take a look at the research on direct primary care and the impact it could have on the broader health insurance and healthcare markets. Dan Sachs is an associate professor of risk and insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business. Dan, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Glad to be here.
This idea of direct primary care, it's been around since the early 2000s. I understand it's picking up some steam. As somebody who researches the economics of healthcare, how have you been tracking these kind of practices and what do we know?
Well, it's something that I've heard about going back several years now. I think it it's fair to say it started off as kind of a boutique area of medicine. In fact, some people call it concierge medicine, and it hasn't been super large, but it's definitely growing. So the way it's worked in the past is that people, in addition to health insurance typically, will sign up for a membership with a direct primary care provider, and that basically gets them more access to their doctor. So you work with a doctor who, instead of being responsible for maybe 1,500 patients, is responsible for 500 or 600, and you're paying more, but you can lock in same-day appointments and just a lot more availability with your primary care provider.
I know a lot of research looks at insurance, the big insurance providers and things like that, so it may not be easy to get a window into questions like this, but do we really have a sense that this is on the rise lately, these direct primary care practices?
Yeah. So to the extent that there is data on it, it does show growing enrollment. So some new research has come out suggesting maybe doubling over the last few years, you know, from a very small base, but it definitely seems to be growing to the extent that we can study it systematically. That's what we see. And then just looking around, I see more and more ads for direct primary care providers.
As you mentioned, the traditional way we think of this has been, okay, it's somebody who already has decent insurance. As you said, they do this direct primary care to get that appointment tomorrow instead of next month or whatever. I'm seeing some anecdotal suggestions that it may be people who don't have insurance or have maybe only catastrophic insurance who want to have something to get day-to-day appointments. Do we have enough window into what's going on to see if that's actually happening?
I can't tell you how much that's happening at scale. I think it is a natural impulse when people are seeing very large premium increases for continued insurance coverage with the end of these enhanced subsidies starting this year. So it makes sense to me that some people might want to switch from paying hundreds to thousands of dollars a month for insurance to something like $50 to $100 a month for direct primary care. Now, they're not getting the same thing.
Right.
Direct primary care gets you access to a doctor in primary care, but it does not get you drug coverage or specialist care or hospital care.
Right. That's something that I think most people in this are on the same page about. Make sure that the people who go into direct primary care understand it is not health insurance. There are things that aren't covered in this, and we don't want people being surprised. What kind of things do you want people to know about this as they're weighing their different options for how do I get health care?
Well, it's just not going to cover the big ticket items. So one, I think, important but maybe surprising statistic is that although for a lot of people, their primary care provider is like the face of their interaction with healthcare, only about 5% of healthcare spending is on primary care. Just the vast majority of it is on everything else. So that's drugs, but also specialist care, hospitalization, surgeries, cancer care. And essentially none of that would be covered with direct primary care.
As we learned through the process of creating the Affordable Care Act, our healthcare system in the United States is pretty complicated, and making what might look like little changes over here can have big ripple effects in different ways. If direct primary care got bigger and more doctors were doing it, more patients were going to it, what kind of questions would you have about how that affects American healthcare overall?
Well, part of the appeal of direct primary care right now is that it's pretty hard to see a doctor. Many people don't have a primary care provider, or if they have one, they have to wait a long time to see their doctor. So that makes it naturally appealing for anyone to sign up for direct primary care. But if more and more physicians move to that model, they'll be seeing fewer patients, and that can actually exacerbate physician shortages. So, you know, if more and more physicians move to these smaller practices in the short run, it might make it harder for everyone else to have a primary care provider. In the long run, I would hope that we would see both more entry into the primary care field and possibly even higher reimbursement rates to attract more doctors into that area.
Right. That's an interesting point. Even setting aside direct primary care, do we have enough doctors as part of the overall pool of physicians going into primary care? What are some of the incentives that say, hey, doctor, you should do this versus being a specialist?
Yeah, primary care is not the most lucrative of specialties. It's not the highest paid profession, and it does not necessarily attract as many medical students as some of the specialties. It can offer better work-life balance. There's more possible control of your schedule, but that schedule control issue also is one of the things that drives people into direct primary care.
Finally, I want to get into the news now. Of course, we've got the Affordable Care Act marketplace, the COVID year enhanced subsidies are going away. People in certain categories are seeing potentially big jumps in premiums if they want to stick with their current plan. How do you see all of that fitting into the decisions people are making about their healthcare coverage?
Well, it's just going to be a lot harder for many people to get coverage. So something like 300,000 people in Wisconsin last year were eligible and took advantage of these subsidies for Affordable Care Act plans. Almost all of them are going to see lower subsidies, and many of them are going to see much higher premiums. So we're going to see people both switching more to catastrophic plans, even higher deductible plans, and increasingly people will say and have said it's just not worth it, and they're not going to get insurance coverage at all.
Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was health economist Dan Sachs, associate professor of risk and insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business. We've been talking about the rise in direct primary care practices, as many Wisconsinites see a jump in health insurance costs with Affordable Care Act enhanced subsidies expiring. Now we turn to a Wisconsin doctor who made the switch and is running her own direct primary care clinic. Dr. Wendy Malaska is a board-certified family medicine physician and the owner of Dedicated Family Care in Madison. She serves on the board of the Direct Primary Care Alliance, a national organization for DPC physicians. Dr. Malaska, thanks for joining us.
I'm so excited to be here. Thanks.
What made you decide to leave what I'll call the insurance-based healthcare system and start this clinic of your own using this direct primary care model?
There were so many things that kind of led up to this. I've been doing primary care for over 20 years, and it just kept getting more and more difficult to provide the type of care I wanted to provide to my patients. Being told to do more and more with less and less, spending more time on administrative work than actually spending time with patients. So finally got to the point where once I heard about direct primary care and learned more about it, took the dive. And although I never imagined myself being a business person, and I don't necessarily like the business aspect of trying to run my own clinic, it allows me to then practice to be the type of doctor that I've always wanted to be so that I can continue to provide kind of full scope family medicine, what I call womb to tomb medicine, to my patients, get the time to spend with them, learn about them and their families, and really try to provide better access and more affordable care for them.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the administrative time involved in dealing with the insurance system, but also now you're managing a business. Do you feel like you're spending more time doctoring and less time administering and red taping?
Oh, for sure. And that's kind of the shocking part to me is that because I don't have to worry about coding and billing and making sure that my note is written in a certain way, I can actually write my notes to reflect the care that the patient is getting and what they're saying. This takes a huge amount of the burden off. It allows me, again, to focus on my patients. I'm no longer trying to type on the computer while I'm talking to them. My computer is off and I'm looking directly at my patients again. So many of my patients comment on that, too. It's like they actually feel heard again and they actually get to spend the time talking to the doc.
Now, this direct primary care, as it's a basic model, different places might offer different kind of services and pricing and things like that. Can you give us a sense of how this works if somebody's paying, I don't know, is it monthly, annually, and then what kind of things do they get out of this model? What kind of services are part of that?
Sure. Direct primary care, as you said, you know, every clinic is slightly different. At mine, I'm family medicine, so I do everything from prenatal care up through the second trimester. I've chosen no longer to deliver babies, but continue to do some prenatal care, take care of infants, children, adults, all the way through hospice care. The monthly fee at my clinic basically covers all of your primary care needs at the clinic. So that means if you come in this week for your annual wellness visit and we diagnose you with possible new high blood pressure and we want to see you again next week, and then the week after that you cut your finger and you need stitches, and the week after that you have a sore throat and want to be tested for strep, you can be seen every week for that same one monthly fee. There are no co-pays, deductibles, co-insurance. So that really makes it a lot more affordable. A lot of my patients say that, you know, the little things can now stay little. They don't put off going to the doctor because of the worry of co-pays and co-insurance and deductibles.
One concern is that people might be paying this monthly fee and, you know, maybe they didn't read carefully, I don't know, and think, okay, I have health coverage. But there are big things that aren't on that list that aren't part of the services you provide. How do you make it clear to patients or would-be patients, these are the things that aren't covered and you'd be paying out of pocket somewhere else?
That's a great question. And the idea is trying to educate patients and the public as a whole about direct primary care and about insurance. If you think about health insurance, we use it differently than every other type of insurance. The analogy I like to use is if you look at your car insurance, you don't use your car insurance to pay for the gas in the car, to get an oil change, even when you have to pony up for some tires or a new battery, that all comes out of your own pocket. You're not using your car insurance to pay for that. That's essentially primary care. It should be easily accessible, like gas stations on every corner, sometimes making an appointment for an oil change and sometimes just driving into Jiffy Lube. The primary care should be easily accessible so that you're able to see your primary physician when you need to for acute things or schedule chronic follow-ups. It should be affordable so that, yeah, you're not going bankrupt when you're seeing your primary care. On the other hand, when you're in a car accident and you need a bunch of body work on your car or the car's totaled and you need a brand new car, that's when you use your insurance. That's when the deductibles kick in and the co-pays and the co-insurance. So for working you up for stomach pain, you can come into my clinic. There's not going to be an extra fee on top of the $85 per month. However, when we diagnose you with your gallbladder stone and you need to consider having your gallbladder taken out, that's not something I'm going to do here in the clinic. That's where you're going to need surgery. That's where I'm going to have to refer you to a surgeon. And that's where you're going to want to use your insurance.
We're talking to Dr. Wendy Malaska, board-certified family medicine physician, owner of Dedicated Family Care, a direct primary care practice in Madison. Dr. Malaska, you mentioned somebody might be doing a service like yours, this direct care, but they might also have insurance. So is it, I can imagine somebody might say, okay, my primary care, I'm going to Dr. Malaska with this monthly thing, and then I'm getting, you know, not a Cadillac kind of insurance, but a catastrophic care. So if I have that big expense, I'm paying some deductibles, but I'm not going to be paying 5-6-digit numbers once I hit that deductible. Is that what you're seeing patients do?
Yeah. So my clinic is very interesting in that we actually have a huge proportion of our patients who are completely uninsured because they're kind of falling through the cracks of making too much for Badger Care here in Wisconsin, but not having healthcare through their employers. So for them, we definitely talk to them about, you know, having some kind of catastrophic plan so that, again, yeah, you're not going bankrupt when you have that hospitalization that you weren't expecting. On the other hand, you are getting all of that primary care that you need so that hopefully you can avoid those other types of hospitalizations.
When it comes to regulation here, I'm sure you have your eye on things going on at the federal and state level. There's been a movement in the state legislature with a lot of bipartisan support to exempt these kind of practices from insurance commission oversight with the argument that, hey, this isn't insurance. What kind of things are you watching for, hoping for or hoping doesn't happen when it comes to regulation of direct primary care?
Yeah, so that I think is the biggest thing that you just mentioned there is that there are at this point about 33 states across the country that have legislation that basically says that direct primary care is not insurance. And it clearly outlines in that legislation, you know, what kind of care we provide, the fact that we're not insurance. And looking at that, we've been actually trying to pass this legislation since about 2019 here in Wisconsin. And the idea is that, yeah, if we don't fall under the insurance commission, then again, we don't have to do some of the coding and billing and all of this extra administration that just adds cost on top of the practice. Direct primary care practices tend to keep their overhead low by avoiding having to have coders and billers and somebody to follow up on denied claims and all of that kind of stuff that goes with insurance. So if we were able to get this passed here in Wisconsin, we would join the majority of states that have this legislation already in place saying that direct primary care is not insurance. It is another option for people to get health care without having to use insurance.
As you mentioned, this is a way to provide care in a way that you want to, spending more time with patients. As a business model, does it feel so far sustainable? Is this something that you think your primary care clinic and others can really do out into the future?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the arguments against DPC is that it's worsening the physician workforce shortages. However, in 2019, when I was changing my practice and then opening my direct primary care, I was at the point of burnout in the systems that I worked for that it was going to be no patients and I was just going to leave medicine entirely. once I heard about DPC and saw the way that this was able to be done and the fact that, you know, this kind of met all of my qualifications, I can have a clinic that serves underserved populations. I can, you know, focus on patient care. I can provide acute, chronic, preventative care. That really made it made me realize that, yes, I can still be a doctor and provide the kind of care that I want and still see patients. I'm no longer seeing 2,500 patients on my panel. I'm seeing 600, but I would say that those 600 are getting much better care than when I was in the system and I had 2,500 patients who couldn't get an appointment to see me for 3 months, who were told to go to the ER or urgent care because my schedule was full.
Finally, we're seeing the end of enhanced Affordable Care Act marketplace subsidies affecting many people, premiums going up as well for many of the marketplace plans. Are you seeing that coming in your door? Are you hearing from patients or maybe getting interest from potential patients who are seeing those premiums change?
Absolutely. So we're seeing a couple of different things, which has been kind of interesting with the ACA premiums going up. One is patients who are actually dropping our services because they feel like they need to have some kind of insurance and the ACA is what's available to them. But now they can't afford even that catastrophic plan on top of a monthly fee at our primary care clinic. We've seen some patients drop it. On the other hand, we're seeing patients drop the ACA and say, well, at least I have the primary care and hopefully nothing goes wrong. And so I will kind of take my chances and hopefully not have to worry about insurance. And then we're seeing those who are changing their plans within the ACA so that they are going with the more catastrophic, higher deductible plans and then coming in and saying, hey, what do we do to help supplement that? And that's where we're seeing a lot of people coming in and saying, oh, direct primary care, that seems to be perfect here. I won't have to use my deductibles and I can get all of that primary care without having to worry about it.
Dr. Malaska, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Wendy Malaska is a board-certified family medicine physician and the owner of Dedicated Family Care, a direct primary care clinic in Fitchburg. Earlier, we heard from health economist Dan Sachs from the Wisconsin School of Business about how the uptick in direct primary care practices could affect the health insurance and healthcare landscapes overall.
Coming up, an organization sends handcrafted letters to children coping with serious illnesses. Hear from the founder of UW La Crosse's chapter of Letters of Love.
Whether it's just a study break or you're just wanting to give back, there's so many different variety of reasons that students are drawn to Letters of Love at La Crosse.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When Grace Burbig was little, her mom would put handwritten notes in her lunchboxes and on her pillows. Those notes became cherished possessions after her mother died of cancer.
Burbig realized the power that handwritten letters can have. While still in high school in 2018, Burbig founded Letters of Love, a nonprofit that sends handcrafted letters to children with cancer and other serious illnesses.
And the idea has exploded. There are now about 300 chapters of Letters of Love at high schools and colleges all over the country, including 5 Wisconsin colleges and 16 high schools. Macy Redman is the president and founder of the UW La Crosse Letters of Love chapter. Macy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Grace Burbig is here. Welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Grace, starting with you, you were inspired to create this nonprofit in honor of your late mother. What was your initial idea for the letters?
Growing up, my mom used to write me and my two little sisters notes all the time in our lunchboxes. She would put them on our walls and our pillowcases, everything. And so when she got diagnosed with leukemia, my sisters and I kind of did the same thing for her, where we would just write her notes and cards every single day. And when I lost my mom about a year after she was diagnosed, I just really wanted to vow to myself that I would never stop giving back to that community, especially kids with cancer. I couldn't imagine watching a child in my life go through what I watched my mom go through. So I just really wanted to give back in that way. And I thought that there needed to be more awareness for emotional support as well.
Why do you think that letters, even from complete strangers, can be so powerful for people to receive?
I think that any handwritten form of love is so special, especially because we live in such a technology world now that it's kind of rare to get a handwritten letter from someone you love, or especially from a stranger telling you, you know, you're special, how incredible your heart is, that you're loved, and all of these things. So I think especially for younger kids, it feels really special for them that they have all of these people from states they've never been to and countries they've never been to, and different sports teams and different schools that are supporting them. It just really makes, I think it's really special because it just feels like you have this worldwide community that's supporting you through your journey.
Macy, what attracted you to the Letters of Love project and caused you to want to create a chapter?
I was introduced to Letters of Love in high school, actually. Although it wasn't at my school specifically, I saw a bunch of neighboring schools participating in it, and I always thought it was such an amazing thing, you know, those handwritten cards for children in children's hospitals. I was really drawn to the idea that something as simple as like a handwritten card could bring comfort to a child who's going through a really hard time. It felt like a small action that could really make a difference, a meaningful difference, and that really stuck with me. I would also say that I've always been just a really creative person doing hands-on service. So when I heard about Letters of Love, combining those two passions, it was pretty much a no-brainer for me that I wanted to in some way be involved in this. So when I came to UWL and saw that that wasn't a club on campus yet, this opportunity just kind of arose, and I thought it was the perfect fit for me.
So when a group of students gather at La Crosse to put some letters together, what is the atmosphere like in that type of gathering? What type of messages are being created?
I would say, first and foremost, it's always so upbeat, and everyone is just gathering with love and great intention in their minds and hearts. You know, you come to this club knowing that you personally, you're not gaining anything from it. You're not getting an accolade or a thing like that, but you're really gaining, you know, that perspective on life, as well as gaining, you know, in your own mind and body that you're helping others and children in need. So I think that it's just a space where it's just filled with love, and everyone that comes is in that like-minded headspace as well.
Grace, these letters, they're sent anonymously to protect the confidentiality of patients, of course, and their families. But how do the people who receive them respond to you?
Like you mentioned, we typically don't know who's receiving the letters, and we never, ever expect any type of response from families. Our only goal is to provide a little bit of joy in their day. We honestly, it's very rare that we ever get a response, and we kind of like it that way because we don't want to add any more responsibility for these parents who are already going through so much. But I will say we have had a few times, probably a handful of times, where parents of patients will reach out to us, and it has been It's honestly hard to find the words to describe how special that is when we're sending out so many cards every month, and you get to actually have a deep understanding and conversation with a family who's going through such a unexplainable time in their life. We've received a lot of gratitude from those families, and we've actually built some really beautiful and long-lasting relationships with families as well, which has been such a blessing.
Your mom would be so proud.
Thank you.
And your organization, it does this big shipment of letters, I think, to pediatric hospitals in December. How did that unfold this year?
Yes, December is one of our biggest months, for sure. December and February are usually our largest months. We received over 50 packages a day, every day in the month of December, which was crazy. I still haven't even gotten close to going through all of them, but we projected that we received around 25,000 to maybe 30,000 cards in December. However, we only have a certain amount of hospitals in the U.S. and other countries that we're starting to expand to that will actually accept cards. So we're really working on expanding to other countries, expanding into Canada, and then also kind of finding some more specialty clinics that have pediatric units so that we're able to really sustain all of this incredible growth that we're experiencing.
Why do you think these card numbers continue to grow?
I think that letters of love, like Macy said, the community that each club creates is so special. I've heard so many stories about people meeting their best friends, their boyfriends at letters of love meetings. I've met my best friends through letters of love. So I think the community is so special. And then I also think that so many young people are really yearning to give back and to make a difference. And I think letters of love, to be totally transparent, really provides a really easy way to do that. Everybody has access to a piece of paper and a pen, and it makes you feel so good knowing that you're putting a smile on a child's face that's enduring, you know, something unimaginable for a child to go through. So yeah, I think it's easy, and it's just so impactful for everyone's hearts who are involved in it.
We're talking about the Letters of Love Project, which sends these handmade greeting cards to sick children and their families around the world. Grace Burbig of Minnesota is founder of the project, and we have Macy Redman with us, head of the UW La Crosse chapter. Macy, why are students drawn to your Letters of Love chapter? What did they say at UW La Crosse?
Ultimately, they're just so drawn to it because, like Grace said, it's such an easy way to give back to families across the world that are in need. And whether it's just a study break, you know, from a busy day at school, it's a creative outlet for you, or you're just wanting to give back. There's so many different variety of reasons that students are drawn to Letters of Love at La Crosse. And I hear it a variety of different ways from our members. You know, just thanking me and my team for hosting these events every other week. They say, you know, it's just such a great break, a way to give back to others. I would say that.
Grace, I understand that this project has become your full-time job. Why do you think that, you know, young people are so enthusiastic about writing these letters? And did you envision that this would become a nonprofit and expand in this way?
When I started Letters of Love, I was 16 and fully planning on going to college and kind of, I don't know, the club kind of fizzling out. It was just a club at my little high school in Minnesota. And I feel like every year since then, honestly, I've been so blown away, and it has exceeded every expectation I could even imagine it having. I was so blessed and so lucky that a donor donated a full salary for me. So it's always been really important for me to promise that everyone who donates, their donations go to our mission. You're allowing kids and students to write cards for kids in the hospital. I was so blessed that this donor came out and just donated a salary for me. I think that's maybe the only way that this would have happened for me for a very long time, but I feel incredibly blessed, and it came at a very pinnacle point for Letters of Love because we're truly experiencing an insane amount of growth.
What goes into packaging and preparing these letters for shipment to hospitals?
So we have a hospital relations team that communicates with every single children's hospital in the U.S., Canada, and every Ronald McDonald House. And we get all of their rules and regulations twice a year. So whenever we get all of these cards in, we check every single one against all of the rules we receive from hospitals. And then we kind of divide them between, you know, religious cards that we're able to only send to religious hospitals, different holidays, you know, et cetera. And then we look at our spreadsheet that has the amount of cards we're able to send to each hospital and then send them out. So it's kind of a long process. It's incredibly important, honestly, the utmost importance to us that we read every single word on every single card, so that we're ensuring that we are being super respectful of every children's hospital's guidelines, and then also ensuring that obviously no negative verbiage or anything like that ever gets out to the kids or the children's hospitals.
Macy, I'm wondering, you know, as you talk about friends coming together to you know, make these cards and building new relationships with new people you're meeting as you put together these cards, I'm wondering, does it help to create community on your campus?
I would 100% say it does. You know, Letters of Love, like I said, it's a place to gather and come together biweekly, but it's not just one major specific or one group of people specific. It really combines the entire university together and for such a good mission. So I would say it's just a great community building asset aside from, you know, other clubs or maybe your major clubs or things like that. I found that it's really combined the entire university. So, you know, grabbing from all different walks of life, I think, has really formed a really strong community on campus.
And Grace, you have about 300 chapters of Letters to Love, of Love, including 21 in Wisconsin, of course, UW La Crosse being one of them. How do you see this project evolving?
Every time I think like that, I feel like Letters of Love grows so much more than I could even imagine. So my hope is honestly that I think we'll still continue evolving. We have almost 300 clubs who have applied on our wait list to start clubs for the following school year.
So wait list, wow.
Yeah, yeah, so that's crazy. I'm confident that we'll continue growing, but really my goal is that we'll grow sustainably. It is always the most important thing to me that Letters of Love is free for every single student. So before we are able to continue growing, we really need to ensure that we have enough funding for every single club so that they'll never be, you know, the funds will never have to come out of the students' pockets in order to give back to this community. I'm hoping next year we'll be in all 50 states. I think we're at 43 now. And then continue growing kind of our roster of countries that we've worked with and have clubs in and things like that. That's really cool.
Is there a season or holiday you like the best?
Definitely Valentine's Day. So February, it's kind of love month for all of our clubs. So we encourage all of our club members to write cards this month to people that they love in their lives. We do kind of different Valentine's Day activities throughout the clubs, and it just feels very Letters of Love to have the whole month dedicated to, you know, love.
I love that. Oh, Macy and Grace, thank you so much for your time and thank you for your work.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That is Grace Burbig, founder of Letters of Love, and Macy Redman, president and founder of the UW La Crosse Letters of Love chapter. We've been hearing about this organization that provides high school and college students with opportunities to send handcrafted cards to children battling serious illnesses in hospitals.
The idea of dry January has taken off over the last 10 years or so, where people take a month off from drinking alcohol.
And even for people who don't want to quit completely for a month, the concept has spread to people cutting back on drinking.
Is this you? Have you given dry January a try or taken the opportunity to limit your alcohol consumption?
Have you replaced some or all of the alcohol in your life with another beverage? Perhaps it's NA beers or mocktails.
If you're willing to share your story, we want to hear about it. You could email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Or you can text us or leave a voicemail anytime. Either way, that number is 888-642-0232. Again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Rochelle Wilson, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.